But now, as part of the John Cage weekend, it's time for Music Matters, presented by Tom Service.
Welcome to a special edition of Music Matters, coming to you from the Barbican Centre in London and the heart of the BBC Symphony Orchestra's weekend of musical mayhem, the celebration of the music of John Cage. So far, they've created 3 days of controversy and controlled chaos. We've had the broadcast of his notorious silent piece, 4 minutes 33 seconds. We've heard an 18-hour piano performance, which finished earlier today, and experienced the riotous energy of a music circus as the whole of the Barbican was taken over by tubas in toilets, amplified bathroom plumbing, and lectures on mushrooms. Well, with all that already behind us and more music to come tonight, I'm joined by three people for whom Cage has been a lifelong passion to discuss the influence of his music and ideas. Laura Kuhn, Executive Director of the John Cage Trust, Tom Johnson, composer and ex-critic of The Village Voice, and Mark Swed, critic of the Los Angeles Times and Cage biographer. Laura, I've been struck by the sheer variety of the Cage pieces we've heard over the last couple of days. And one thing that seems to connect them, I guess I'm thinking of the silent piece in particular, is that they experiment with our idea of what music actually is. So was Cage, as Arnold Schoenberg said, instead of being a composer, rather an inventor of genius?
Well, I don't know that I would put it in those terms, but I would say that in response to your speaking about variety, that he certainly was probably the most experimental person I'd ever known and probably will ever know, in the sense that he was always doing something new. He tended not to repeat himself. And if you look at his compositional styles across his career, that, I mean, he had major, major, major changes, you know, every sort of decade or so. This festival is representing a good portion of those styles, but not all.
Tom, from your direct experience working on The Village Voice and seeing that development, Cage's development firsthand, is it his ideas which are going to be his legacy, or is it rather the pieces themselves?
I think he was first of all a composer, and what is going to last is the music. And I was a little annoyed to hear the word mayhem and chaos already in the program, as if we're introducing the idea as the man who made mayhem and chaos. And he did have a lot of theater pieces that were kind of crazy, and lots of experiments that he did. But finally, he was a very serious composer, and I think what's a lot of the times we laugh at some of his theatrical experiments, just because we haven't yet understood that it's music.
Mm-hmm. Mark Swed, are we not taking Cage seriously then?
Not entirely, and I would say that I believe Cage is a composer of genius and a pretty good inventor.
I would agree with that.
And I think one thing that should maybe be clarified from the beginning is that there is absolutely no evidence that Schoenberg ever made that statement, that Schoenberg was... It really came secondhand many years after Schoenberg died.
I mean, didn't Cage tell us that Schoenberg said that?
Cage heard that from someone who had told that to Cage many years after Schoenberg died, but there's no evidence that Schoenberg had ever said it. In fact, it's highly dubious. But Cage loved hearing it, of course, and repeated it many, many times, and was amused by it.
But then how do you defend him as a composer, then, as opposed to an inventor?
I think the music holds up as an amazing oral experience. And it's music that I've now lived with for just about all of my life. And I spend my life as a music critic in the world of all classical music all the time. And throughout all of that, I'm always brought back to Cage, and I'm always incredibly moved and incredibly taken by this music.
Mm. Is that something you all share?
In a very deep way.
Of course, and I, you know, let me, you know, toss my PhD onto the table here.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you know, seriously, I have a PhD in musicology from UCLA, and I chose to do a dissertation on Cage. And, you know, that was not because I thought his ideas were interesting. It was because I was deeply affected by the pieces that he wrote. And I'm continue to be deeply affected by those pieces the more I learn them. You know, the more I understand the complexities and the nuances and the delicacies of his compositional systems.
But isn't there a kind of contradiction there, though, Tom Johnson? If we're, you know, Cage is someone who spent his whole life trying to kind of break down the barriers, if you like, between what we might call the aesthetic concert hall, the things we, concert hall experiences, and the rest of life, letting noise in, making us experience our everyday lives as pieces of music. So if we're now saying
he wrote great pieces, isn't it? He wanted to broaden the definition of music, but he never said he wasn't a composer. And some people really, somebody in Paris, lately said that John Cage himself admitted that he wasn't a composer. That's completely false. I heard him speak many times, and I knew him pretty well. I never heard him say anything remotely like that. I did hear him many times say, for example, this concert was so terrible I wanted to. The reaction from the audience was so terrible, and I thought I could just walk off the stage. I really was terrible to be there. But I didn't, because I remembered my promise to Schoenberg. Schoenberg told me, well, you don't have a sense of harmony. You'll never be a composer. And I told him, then I will beat my head against the wall the rest of my life. I will be a composer.
Well, let's just, we're all agreed, or you three are agreed, that Cage is a composer. But let's just hear from a couple of people, some recorded testimony from Karlheinz Stockhausen and Virgil Thompson, who take a rather different view.
I have always doubted his musicianship since I knew him, because he has no real inner vision. He doesn't hear. For me, a musician begins to be a musician when he hears something that nobody else hears. It is just a shock in the history of European tradition that someone like him can be called a composer.
I still consider it a heresy, and it comes from Cage's facile handling of rigid ideas rather than from his being a musical natural. Pierre Boulez had a fantastic ear. Cage does not have that ear. Cage is forced into arithmetic and doctrinaire ideas by his lack of that kind of musical ear.
So, Laura Kuhn, was Cage a heresy then?
The idea of that is just patently ridiculous. I mean, it's just too silly for words. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Virgil Cage had their long ago falling out, so it's hard to know where that quote comes from. But, I mean, it's interesting that they both reduce it down to an ear, you know. There have been many composers who don't have perfect pitch, who don't, you know, who have to study scores, who have to memorize things. You know, for me, that it's never been, historically speaking at least, is not a measure of greatness in a composer.
Right. But this is, they should have known that Cage had an ear. I mean, never heard the sonatas and interludes?
We still, in a kind of popular consciousness, don't associate Cage with these pieces. We still think of the notorious 433 before we think of the number pieces, don't we?
Well, we do, and for fairly obvious reasons.
Wait a minute, who's we?
433 is a better name.
I mean, I'm thinking, we in this case could be very precisely defined as the British media, because, you know, everything from The Sun to The Guardian has run a piece about 433, right, rather than the number pieces.
It's newsworthy.
Yeah, the idea of the ear is actually very interesting, because the situation with John is he trusted the ear more than either Virgil or Stockhausen ever did. I mean, it was this idea that you had to trust what you heard at every moment and believe in those sounds. And the concept of a vision is a curious one. And I think it is something that Stockhausen certainly has,
right,
but it's this idea of predicting. And Cage was in the business of living with your ear and living with these sounds and understanding them as you're hearing them.
Laura's right that there's a lot of differences between the 43 number pieces, and sometimes he didn't specify exactly. But in most of those pieces, he chose the notes and the instruments. And there are cases where he uses soft timpani, for example, in chamber ensemble in a very special way. And sometimes the wind instruments are voiced in order to get very special effects. If they come a little before or a little later, doesn't matter. It's gonna make that special
Absolutely.
Voice.
But nonetheless, I mean, there is a kind of, I guess, part of the serious point that Stockhausen maybe is making. We might say it's ridiculous to say that Cage didn't, you know, that one should doubt Cage's musicianship. But nonetheless, Stockhausen's opinion is not an isolated one. I mean, really, the whole kind of European modernist tradition turned against Cage precisely because they didn't think he was a composer. Didn't they?
Well,
Stockhausen and Boulez.
Not everybody. Everybody?
Well, of course, we hear a lot of that in Paris because the Boulez influence was so strong in Paris, and Cage's music is hardly ever played in Paris as a result of that, except when Merce Cunningham comes through, and then it gets played with the dancers, but not by the orchestras and by the ensembles. And so there's a general... I think one problem is that Cage liked Eric Satie, and Eric Satie is not very appreciated in France either, or anything that's simple and direct.
Nor is Berlioz.
The French style they prefer things that are more complex. Mm-hmm.
But they did appreciate Cage as a composer, and very much so, and I think that's the key thing. Stockhausen was very influenced by Cage and close to Cage in the 50s.
Yeah.
Boulez was very influenced by Cage and very, very close to Cage in the early 50s. And when Cage would move on to the next step, they didn't go in that direction. They went somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So what you have is a divergence of compositional ideas and a greater change in the work from Cage than what the other composers were doing, but they very much appreciated him, and part of it is that they felt a little bit betrayed.
We're going to hear now from somebody for whom Cage's music made an absolutely direct, emotional, visceral impact on their life. We're going to hear a specially recorded essay from theatre director Jude Kelly, who's telling us how Cage's Inner Landscape became a symbol of meditation and calm during a critical period in her emotional and professional life.
In a landscape, one long unaccompanied melody without resolution. From the moment I first heard this piece by John Cage, it absorbed me for its beauty and its philosophy. He wrote it, as he said, to quiet the mind, rendering it susceptible to divine influences. Well, as a woman without a conventional god to relate to, this profound piece gave a structure for me to reflect on my life as I set about a period of change. It was autumn 1999. I was directing Chekhov's The Seagull. Ian McKellen, Claire Higgins, Claudie Blakely were part of a wonderful cast who'd come to Leeds for the adventure of creating an ensemble company for 6 months. I had begun the internal grieving process that goes with knowing one will leave someone you love. The West Yorkshire Playhouse, which I as a director had helped to build, was now over 10 years old. Time to go. My heart started telling me, creativity thrives on risk. But leaving a deep-rooted part of oneself behind is a kind of death, and death is fearful. I played the actors a recording of Inner Landscape. Cage's piece seemed so linked to the weaving, evasive, emotional tension of Chekhov's play, and I decided to use it as the musical motif between acts. Chekhov and Cage had an equal mastery over an internal as well as an external truth. Both of them were also fascinated by how to contemplate and fathom time. And as a company, this pierced into all our artistic and personal concerns. Our days are passing, weeps Polina in The Seagull. But what's to be done? Replies the vainglorious Arcadina. Greenwich Mean Time was a factor in all our lives then. The millennium approached, like some demi-day of judgment. What have you done in your life, Jude Kelly? Can you justify it? Is it sufficient? In a landscape, one long, unaccompanied melody without resolution, I played it many times, reminding myself we are unable to control time or the meaning of life within it. Time. 10 joyful years at the Playhouse flew past, and yet always to me there's been another rhythm of time, that moves neither backwards or forwards, but somehow circles, shifts in a different harmony to everyday human actions, ambitions, or schemes. That summer, impelled by this sense of change inside me, I'd taken a lease on a decaying London building without any sense of how I'd pay for it, convert it, use it. But I felt it was destined to play a part in the next stage of my life, and I trusted that time would reveal the reason. John Cage time, not Greenwich Mean Time. Inner Landscape edged me towards tranquility. Whenever I was about to panic in the face of such a rash decision, Inner Landscape stilled my mind, its colourless emotion and absence of urgency creating a startling serenity. The characters in The Seagull convey a mood of spiritual discouragement, helplessness before the overwhelming impersonal forces of circumstance, an awareness of personal insignificance. Most fear death. "I'm still adrift in a chaos of dreams and images," confesses Konstantin. "No idea where I'm going or what I'm for." John Cage's music meditates, without melancholy or melodrama, on the futility of trying to grasp hold of time and squeeze it to extract immediate gratification or meaning. Cage's music speaks of the notion of providence. "I used to claim I was unafraid of real death, but now I think I was fooling myself. Caring about the worth of one's life, isn't that fear of death? And feeling responsible for staying creative with all its sense of birth and partings. Maybe that's an acknowledgement of time's rhythm and the inevitability and appropriateness of death." The millennium struck, we were proud of our production of The Seagull and pleased it was highly regarded. We'd been on a good journey together. 3 years later, I stand in Metal, my working studio, renovated and transformed. An artistic life is filled with friends and acquaintances. I never met John Cage, but I felt his presence like a friend. In a landscape, like life, is a long, unaccompanied melody without resolution. I can find courage in Cage's philosophy and solace in his music.
Theatre director Jude Kelly. Jude was eloquently expressing the directness of impact that Cage's music had on her life there. Is that something that you can relate to?
What I was thinking as I listened to that is, how can somebody permit themselves to say that Cage didn't have an ear when they're listening to music like that?
I think it's one of the most profound things about Cage is the profoundly personal effect he had on the people around him. You know, not just people he met, but people who are exposed to his music, people who are exposed to his ideas. You know, that continues very, very much to this present day. You know, new generations of listeners. We get a lot of letters and calls and just contact at the John Cage Trust, very young people who discover him for the first time. And he continues to have the same kind of powerful resonance for them that he had for me and my generation.
But again, it's another kind of paradox that the strength of personal engagement that people feel with this output, when Cage, I mean, was trying to get away from the idea of intention, away from the idea of directness of communication or expression, and yet this is music and his ideas that speak incredibly directly to people.
Because it gave room for people to actually think.
One piece that meant very much to me at one point, and I still love it, is the Lecture on Nothing. Mm. That's not pure music, but it's a very powerful piece, and it's composed rhythmically. Mm-hmm.
Mark Sweat, are there pieces that have that kind of resonance for you?
I tend to fall in love with just about each of the pieces as I'm involved with it. So, I mean, it's yes and no. There's no single piece that turned my life around. It's something, I think, a lot larger.
Do you remember, Mark, the first piece of Cage's you ever heard live?
I remember the first concert of Cage's, which was done at the Pasadena Art Museum in 1964 when I was a high school student.
Wow.
He gave they had just done a Duchamp retrospective at the Art Museum, and Cage came and did a concert, and I was a high school student, very interested in Schoenberg and Stravinsky, and I just thought this was the most interesting and a most amazing thing I had ever heard. Hmm. And it was him, it was the music, and it was just the sort of opening my eyes to new possibilities.
It's one thing for us as listeners to kind of fall in love with the music in that way, but it's something that the musicians, the performers themselves, have to fall in love with as well. And that's not something I think we always get from performances of Cage.
Oh, no. And John had more problems with musicians than any composer I know. And because he was doing something quite different. And then for an interpreter to play non-intentionally is not easy. You have to have a conductor that explains it, and usually there isn't a conductor who really understands, and things don't go so well.
Laura, I mean, do we have a problem in disseminating that idea of non-intention, you know, getting that through performers to musicians?
It's such a large question, hard to address here in this very, very quick context, but I will say this, that I agree absolutely with Tom, and the problem really is in situations where musicians are playing Cage against their will, if you will. So the problem is really with orchestral performances of Cage, where it's very, very clear. I wish that orchestral musicians could see from the audience's point of view when they're performing Cage, because it becomes very clear within seconds whether or not the player's happy about this.
I mean, have you detected any of that as part of the BBC Symphony Orchestra's weekend?
Oh, sure.
You can tell us about specific examples.
Well, of course. I mean, we haven't had that many examples, but I know last night with Winter Music and Atlas and Cartridge Music.
You can hear the broadcast of that on Monday. Tomorrow night it'll be broadcast on Radio 3.
Wonderful. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. But it was problematic in the sense that it was fairly clear that the musicians were unhappy about numerous things, not just playing of Cage, but the way that the piece had those three pieces were brought together, which is another topic unto itself. But
Well, I wonder at that point, we can just hear Earl Brown, a colleague of John Cage's, talking really exactly about the kind of problems that orchestral musicians faced exactly in that context of Atlas Eclipticalis.
I had a feeling, and I used to argue with John about it, that he was not giving enough information to the musicians to allow them to have the confidence to do what he imagined they might do. His conditions that he presents to the musicians are ambiguous, and they are, in a certain way, some of the things he does are insulting to the musicians, and I've seen the musicians revolt. It's kind of naive for John to expect that 85 people in the New York Philharmonic are going to go along with his philosophical idea that either you're heard or you're not heard and it doesn't make any difference. He was not dealing with what I knew to be the psychology of a group of musicians.
Earl Brown. So, I mean, is the problem Cage's then?
I want to respond to one particular thing, because I think something that Earl said is extremely important, and this business about confidence. And I think that is key to it. I probably worded it improperly before. I don't think that it's so much that they're antagonistic to Cage or Cage's ideas. I think they lack confidence. I think that the divergence of style, compositionally and performance-wise, is so great that they don't have any, and as Tom was saying, they're not prepared. They don't know how to do this.
One reason they lack confidence is because they heard somebody say Cage is not a composer.
Or whatever,
they read somewhere all these bad notes. And I wanted to say something more about that. I think often in Europe people don't respect Cage because they think, oh, he's the primitive American. He didn't go to the Paris Conservatoire, and he didn't even...
He
did go to the Conservatoire. No, he had two lessons, but he was there.
Right. But in fact, of all the generation of Boulez and Stockhausen and Berio and the others, the only one who studied personally with Schoenberg was John Cage. He studied 2 years with Schoenberg. And I think he was very young. He was studying harmony and counterpoint. He wasn't a composer yet. But I think we can see in his music this extreme discipline that he used with the chance system was the discipline that he learned from Schoenberg, and discipline that you don't find in many other post-Webern composers.
One thing to remember in Cage's, in the whole issue of performance, is nearly every one of Cage's pieces was written for a specific performer. And it's very important to understand how that works. For example, 4 minutes and 33 seconds was written for David Tudor, who was one of the two or three greatest piano virtuosos of his time, just technically. He had a technique that was unbelievable. And the difficulty, the sheer difficulty for a virtuoso to not play is this is a major theatrical event, actually. And it's something that, and the Atlas Ecliptocalis example that Earl was talking about. Now, Earl was actually being a little naive in one sense. That piece was not written for the New York Philharmonic. It was written for a group of student musicians who were very interested in doing this. And then it was Leonard Bernstein's idea to try and do it with the New York Philharmonic. And Bernstein did not prepare the musicians properly this is a very different job of the conductor's job in many of these pieces is to rehearse, and they don't understand, but to rehearse in a different way than they've rehearsed before, and that's where they fail.
There is a problem, though. I mean, you know, if you think about the Atlas Ecliptocalis is now over 40 years old, and we still haven't generated an orchestral culture, it seems, who are able to respect and deal with these kind of. You know, but the kind of demands is possibly the wrong word. The kind of relationship with music, with the score suggests.
I don't know that it's orchestral culture. I don't want to go that far because that bunches it all together. Yeah. I remember turning to Stephen Montague, who I sat next to last night, saying that you know I would know that we had progressed as a culture when the orchestral musicians were as receptive and open to that which they were doing as the audiences were becoming. That in fact, I think that audiences have progressed. So the orchestral culture, if you will, which is partly the audience, partly the performers, et cetera. I mean, other parts as well. But that the audience is actually, I find them in general more receptive than the people on the stage.
Yeah.
So I think the problem is a legitimate one, but I don't know that it's a really cultural one at this point.
I just want to bring this back to composers, because you talked about a European vision of Cage as a kind of primitive American. I was struck by something that John Adams wrote in his foreword to The Whole Weekend, which is the program, the BBC Symphony Orchestra's program for The Whole Weekend. And John Adams' aesthetic is very different from John Cage's, but at the end of it, he seems to suggest that Cage's ideas have actually kind of had their time, that actually it was a kind of stage that we had to go through, and now we can go back to the idea of respecting a tradition, and, you know, we can bring ego back in. I wonder if you could all just comment on whether you think Cage's ideas have had their day in that sense, that, you know, we've passed through it, we come out the other side, now, hey, we can just go back to Beethoven writing big symphonic scores. Mark?
Yes and no. I mean, all ideas are of their time. And Cage's were more than ever of his time. But that doesn't mean they don't continue to resonate. I think very little of what he felt and thought and worked with has actually come through yet and is well understood